I want to take a break from the podcast right now, and I want to give you a gift. And I want to do that to thank you for being a listener. I put my heart and soul into this podcast. I love interviewing today's experts, researchers, MDs, psychologists, sleep trainers, you name it. I hope you feel inspired to take care of yourselves and your families. And I just want to thank you for being a listener and hanging out with me. So the code PODCAST10 is going to give you a one-time $10 off code at kellylevesque.com, your next order of protein powder. You can either use that on my grass-fed beef isolate protein or on my new vegan chocho bean protein. Now, here's what I love about my protein powders. It's 3 ingredients or less. So we don't use fillers, emulsifiers, no fortified vitamins or minerals. It's easy to digest and naturally made without any enzymes or chemicals like hexane. So it's 3 ingredients. With my grass-fed beef isolate, that's 100% grass-fed beef, and it's made in the way that you would make bone broth. So just heat and water. And we dehydrate that end product to get that collagen-rich protein powder that your whole family can drink. It can be added to coffees, to smoothies, and you can get it in vanilla, chocolate, and unflavored. I want to point out that my vanilla and chocolate is made with organic vanilla bean, organic cacao, and the only sweetener used is organic monk fruit. We don't use any maltodextrin. Our monk fruit is 100% ground monk fruit, and it's organic. And with my vegan line, I'm so excited to have launched this and to have it out into the world. It's a regenerative bean from South America called the chocho bean. And the chocho bean is the most superior plant-based protein powder you can get your hands on, because not only is it a complete protein, but the process is made with heat and water only. They're crushed and soaked, and what that end product results in is an anti-nutrient-free protein powder. So you're not gonna have any lectins, phytates, or oxalates in your protein powder. Makes it super easy to digest, and it's really, really delicious and robust in cooking as well. So I love it if I want a thicker smoothie or a smoothie bowl. And I also love it in my baked goods, from my cookies to my muffins, pancakes, and breads. It's the perfect protein addition. So if you want to give either of these proteins a try, or you've already been purchasing these proteins and want to take advantage of this special deal, the code PODCAST10 is going to get you $10 off for being a listener here at the Be Well by Kelly podcast. So head to kellylevesque.com or bewellbykelly.com. Put the protein you'd like to purchase in your cart and use the code PODCAST10 for $10 off. Thank you, thank you, thank you for tuning in.
Simon Hill is a physiotherapist and a nutritionist who is passionate about making nutritional information simple and accessible. Over the years, Simon became increasingly curious about the role nutrition played in nourishing the body and preventing disease. Simon investigated the vast evidence out there showing that simple lifestyle changes could help people prevent and sometimes even reverse many of the leading chronic lifestyle diseases. Concerned with the fact that this information was not reaching people widely, Simon shifted gears in his career, undertaking a plant-based nutrition certificate and a postgraduate degree in nutrition. He set up plantproof.com and began hosting world-renowned doctors and public figures on the Plant Proof podcast. Through his channels, Simon's hope is that more of us will work together to create a more equitable, beautiful, and peaceful world. So let's welcome Simon to the podcast and get really motivated and excited to eat a lot of fiber and greens.
I kind of just want to know, like, how you started on your quest for health.
Yeah, when I was 15, I saw what loss of health looks like for the first time. And I think up until then, I thought that, you know, life was just rosy and you live until you're the age of my grandparents and you're healthy and you enjoy life and then you pass away. And I think I had never really been faced with death or someone close to me being diagnosed with any significant condition that sort of flipped their life upside down. And I grew up in Melbourne, in Australia. And on weekends, my dad and my brother and I, we would often spend a lot of time together exploring an area outside of Melbourne called the Yarra Valley. And this is like a really fun area. There's lots of wineries. And I was a kid. It wasn't so much about the alcohol. I mean, my dad was, of course, allowing me to try different types of wine. And that was part of it. It was fun, but it was more about spending time together. And on this particular Sunday afternoon, it was just my dad and I, and we were driving back home to get ready to prepare dinner. And he started to feel some discomfort in his chest, and I could see that he was uncomfortable. And he was kind of rubbing or grabbing at his chest a little bit. And I inquired and asked him, you know, if everything was okay. And he reassured me that, yeah, he did have a bit of pain in his chest, but he thought it was nothing and it would go away. So he thought. And we proceeded to go home. We cooked dinner, and I went off to bed, and he had reassured me again that everything was completely okay. And really, I had no reason to believe that things were not okay, because my dad was 41 years old. You know, that's very young. And he had two kids. He was living the typical Australian lifestyle. From the outside, he wasn't someone you would look at and think, you know, they're unhealthy. They live an unhealthy lifestyle. That wasn't my dad. And so this was, you know, something that came from nowhere out of the blue. And I headed off to bed, and my parents were divorced when I was about 10 or 12. So I was actually at my dad's place, and my brother and my mom were in the city. So it was just me with him on this night. And a little while after, I heard quite a bit of noise in the kitchen, and I went out to see what was happening. And this was the first moment that I think I'd ever seen my dad with fear in his eyes, you know, vulnerable. He was no longer in a position where he could deny what was going on. And, you know, I think this sort of stage of denial when we're experiencing poor health is quite common, and, you know, perhaps even more common in males who tend to put off going and seeing the doctor and sort of have this mindset of, maybe if I don't think about it, it'll go away. Our physiology sometimes, you know, has its own mind. And so when I went out and I saw him, he had grabbed the phone. And by this stage, he was pale. He was out of breath. And he had called 000, which is the Australian version of 911. And I took over the phone call to help describe what was happening to him, to the paramedic. And they said to me, you know, where are you located? And we were out in this wine sort of region, which is a long way away from the nearest hospital. At least it wasn't that time. I'm not sure if they've ever built a hospital since then. And so they said, look, we need to send a helicopter. Is there somewhere that we can land a helicopter on the property? And fortunately, there was. It was a very treed, foresty area, but there was enough cleared space behind the house to land a helicopter. And so they said, well, we're going to send a helicopter. We need to get your dad to the nearest hospital ASAP. And they helicopter arrived so quickly, and they came in with a stretcher and scooped my dad up off the ground. They attached oxygen and, you know, lots of different cords and cables and measuring vital signs and whatnot. I didn't really know what was happening at the time, but now I'm sure that's what they were doing. And they were, you know, checking if he was stable, and that was happening at a million miles an hour. So it wasn't a time for really discussion about what was going on. It was just a very frantic period. I was 15. It was coming out of nowhere, hours before we were having a great day like we always had. And so it was very frightening. And they took him to the helicopter. I couldn't fit. They said, you can follow by ambulance. And before I knew it, my dad was in the helicopter and on the way to the hospital. And I called my mom and my brother and said, this is what's happening. You better come to the hospital. And we got there, and we waited and waited and waited. And the doctor came out and said to us, you know, your dad has had a serious heart attack. And fortunately, we saved his life. And he's very lucky. A lot of people that experience this are not so lucky, and they don't get a second chance at life. So we were very, very grateful, still very shocked that at 41, you know, my dad, who was not taking any medications, he was not reliant on the healthcare system, that he, of all people, would experience this. It just, it didn't make sense. And so the next day we had a bit of a family debrief, and the cardiologist sort of sat us down and said, you know, here's what's happened. Here's your dad's prognosis. He will be on some medications for cholesterol and blood pressure and things for the rest of his life. And I've taken your dad's history, and his father, so my grandfather, had also had a heart attack. And his advice to my brother and I was that as you become adults, and I was 15 and my brother was 18, you should be aware of this and be screened. And that is good advice, but it's where the conversation ended, unfortunately. And so from there, for many years, my brother and I had a very limiting belief that, you know, my dad's experience was, you know, by and large explained by genetics, or that's what we thought. And so, you know, fast forward over a decade later, and having done a master's in nutrition science and got my head a little more around the data that we have, I was able to flip that narrative and see that, you know what, we do have genetic predispositions. That's right. But really, except for very rare genetic variants, mutations, where someone is very, very unlucky, and no matter how they live, that disease comes to fruition. Except for that, by and large, these chronic diseases that we have normalized in our societies, like having a heart attack at a young age, or various types of cancers, not all, but a lot of them, type 2 diabetes, Alzheimer's, dementia, by and large, these are running in our families, not necessarily just due to our genetics, but because as a family, we're living the same way. Mm-hmm. And when I was able to really make sense of that, you feel the shift from a state of being disempowered to a very empowering state where you feel in control of your health.
That's so powerful, just to think about what you went through at such a young age and how it led you on this path. Do you think watching your dad go through what he went through and having that emergency situation literally in your control, you're communicating to the 000 operator that this is what's happening and we need your help, and to be there in the hospital and to have the doctor say, like, you just need to be screened. Do you think that led you on your path to get a master's in nutrition? You think like that was like the tipping point, or like the straw that broke the camel's back that made you curious?
Yeah. It definitely had significant impact, and ultimately was a driving force behind wanting to understand science, certainly. And initially when I went, because my master's in nutrition science was after I had an undergraduate in the science degree, physiotherapy. My real interest in going back and doing the master's was that I was finding it difficult myself, despite having a basic level of understanding of physiology and biology, to make sense of all of the polarized views out there. And, you know, really I was interested to find out, you know, what are the facts that we can rely on so that I could improve my health and perhaps help those around me, my family and friends. Now, I do think I would have always ended up in science space. You know, I saw a photo, my dad sent me a photo just a couple of days ago. From as far back as I can remember, I would, you know, come home to piles and piles of scientific papers everywhere around the house. My dad did his PhD originally in Texas in physiology and has gone on to have a 40-year career as a professor in physiology with a specialty, ironically, in looking at risk factors for cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes. And so his research, Kelly, is like deep research. And this photo he sent me is him like in the 1970s or 80s, like on a microscope in the lab. He's looking at sort of, you know, petri dish, looking at human cells and arterial vascular stiffness and arterial function and all that sort of very, very deep science. But because I was surrounded by that from such an early age, I always was very curious about science and how we could use science to really test our hypotheses and our intuition in a sort of formal, objective manner to help us reduce some uncertainty and have more confidence in the decisions that we make, the recommendations that we make in order to really just improve the human experience.
Well, it sounds like you were faced with and seeing this major polarization, kind of like what you would call the diet wars out there. And you ultimately ended up going back to school to kind of flush through the research and to see what was working. Before we started this call, you mentioned that the best that we can do is we can start making and taking action steps on the research we know is true. So I'd love for you to kind of talk a little bit about some of the diet misconceptions and the problems you see with diet wars. And then I'd love to go into some of the action steps we can all take to take better care of ourselves, no matter where we fall, on whatever side of the diet war we're on, or the carb war, or you name it.
the diet wars are interesting. Myself personally, I'm not actually huge on labels, which often surprises people.
Yeah, you wouldn't think that if you went to your Instagram.
Yeah, you would. I mean, if science doesn't really care about the labels that we come up with. And if we look at the totality of the evidence, what's clear is that there is not one sort of optimal dietary brand label that we have conjured up. There is a set of characteristics that we see time and time again are associated with the best health outcomes. People who have lower risk of having a heart attack or a stroke, or less risk of developing fatty liver disease or type 2 diabetes or Alzheimer's dementia. And these diets, dietary patterns, I should say, are characterized by a few sort of commonalities. They're low in saturated fat. They are rich in unsaturated fats, provide good amounts of these unsaturated fats. They tend to be, you know, low in the ultra processed foods. They contain good amounts of fiber, and they do contain good amounts of plant protein in there. Now, the interesting thing about what I just described is that that can be done in a number of different ways. There are a lot of different variations of that, which people can choose based on what feels right for them and what they're going to be able to sustain for the longest period of time. Because, you know, neither you or we don't want someone to change the way they're eating just for 2 weeks. This is about finding a variation of what I just described, which could be and it can be an omnivorous diet. It can be a thoughtfully constructed Mediterranean diet. It could be a pescatarian diet if someone wants. It could be a vegetarian or a plant-exclusive diet, depending on where someone wants to land. But the key point being that finding the overall dietary pattern that leaves you feeling the best and that you can sustain for the longest. And I believe that no matter, you know, which variant someone chooses, as long as it is ticking those boxes, low in saturated fat, providing good amounts of unsaturated fat, it is minimizing ultra processed foods, lots of fiber and some plant protein in there, then people are going to get really, really good results.
So if someone comes to you and they have been a specific lifestyle for a long time and they feel this connection to that community, how do you advise people? Because I know it can be like tribal. You can feel this connection to this group, and it's not really that they're focused on what is maybe the healthiest for them. And they even find it hard to leave that tribe because they've connected so deeply with it. How are you like advising your community, and how are you personally checking in with yourself to ensure that like how you're eating is really still working for you long term?
This is a really good point. And And I often explain to people that science is looking at the aggregate, the average, but you're not the average, right? None of us are. So I think, and this is why I really do believe there's a set of characteristics, but after that, there is personalization that's required to leave you feeling at your best. And I just encourage people not to forget that. You deserve to feel at your best, and playing around with that theme that I described, variation, to find what's working best for your body is something that I encourage. You know, you're right. You can fall into the trap of perhaps identifying with a certain label, and maybe that can come at the expense of your health if it's so rigid. Now, I would add a caveat to that some people are making food choices not just based on their health, and they might be considering planetary health, animal welfare. And so I kind of understand that there might be people listening that perhaps are in that position. And if they're not feeling at their best, I still encourage them to think about the way they're constructing that diet, because you can have a pescatarian, vegetarian, or a vegan diet that's very poorly constructed. And so we need to understand that, you know, particularly the word vegetarian and vegan, that is not synonymous with health. You know, that can be done in a number of different ways. And there are a whole lot of ultra processed foods that tick the boxes as falling under those labels as well. But, you know, generally the position that I come from is more about explaining there are a number of ways to get optimal health, and letting the person on the other end explore that and find the level of commitment that feels right for them. And I do think you make a great point that we all deserve to feel at our best. So if you're not feeling at your best, then you should be asking questions. You should be exploring that.
Definitely. I think we connected based on your optimistic approach. You're very positive, add to your life. This is a cool new study. You can change your life. Like, I feel like a little bit, not to say you're a preacher, but you're out there being like, there's this new study. It's really awesome. You can implement it in your life and feel awesome too. Which I love. Like, I think that's, it's a breath of fresh air, and there are diet wars and there is negativity out there in the health space. And I think you do a really good job of giving people action steps, and these action steps are linked to research, and they're study backed, which I love. So I'd love to go through some of these research backed recommendations that you make. I'd love to talk about fasting and meal timing. I'd love to talk about the new study out of Stanford on fermented foods that I saw you talk about. So let's dip into some of the research around a plant-based diet, because you mentioned, you know, you can be an omnivore, you can be Mediterranean, you can be vegetarian, you can be predominantly plant-based. But what I see when I look at all those diets is that there are plants, there's fiber. Yeah. So can we talk about the why behind that?
And that's a great point that you just make, is that actually when we hear this word plant-based, I do think a lot of people think that means plant exclusive. Yeah. However, in the scientific research, and you'll be familiar with this, plant-based is used to describe a Mediterranean diet, which is an omnivorous diet. You know, that diet contains seafood, it contains dairy in there, and it still contains, there's room in there for chicken and red meat, but it's at a sort of more de-emphasized level than, say, a standard Western diet. Now, zooming in on fiber, is that where you wanted to go here?
Let's go there first. Okay. My favorite thing. I mean, it's one of my favorite things.
I know. I'm going to tell you everything you already know, and your listeners have probably heard this a bunch. But
I think we need to hammer it home though, because I don't know. I mean, even me, when I know the research, being reminded of it, I'm like, okay, I'm going to add a little side salad to that meal, or I'm going to roast up that extra broccoli that's in that drawer in the refrigerator. Or, you know, you're just remotivated. And I feel like with all the information out there, people are being pulled in every direction. They're like, now I'm going to do X, Y, and Z, or keto, or fall over here, you know, and you can kind of get pulled in different directions. And I always love bringing back, like, if your grandma ate it, it's probably great for you. It's plants. Let's make plants sexy right now.
Yeah. And you hear eat rainbow. We've heard that for years. Yeah. And it's such a simplified message, but you know, there's a lot of truth in that. So our understanding of the microbiome has obviously grown immensely over the last decade or so with, you know, rapid progress in terms of technology that's allowed us to actually take a peek inside the large intestine, often called the colon, and to sort of get an idea as to what is going on in there, because there is this wild ecosystem. And in fact, there's 38 trillion microbes in there, which is, you know, a greater number than the number of stars in the Milky Way. It's kind of mind-blowing to think about that. If you were to take out all of the bacteria from your colon and you were to weigh it, it's around about the same weight as a standard brick that you'd use to build a house. So think about holding a brick. Like, there's a fair bit of weight in that. And that is equivalent to all of this bacteria that we have a symbiotic relationship with. You know, for a long time, bacteria was painted as the enemy. But, you know, and while there are certain pathogenic bacteria that perhaps we want to minimize, overall, the microbiome is something that sustains us, and we sustain the microbiome. And that's essentially the definition of that symbiotic relationship. If we look after it and nurture it, it will do the same for us. It will reward us. By when I say it, I mean collectively all the different species. So at a high level, what research has been able to tease out, and a lot of this is association, it's not cause and effect, is that healthier people who have less disease tend to have a more diverse microbiome. And unhealthier people seem to lose that diversity. And we know that lifestyle directly impacts that. We know specifically when it comes to diet, the key component of our diet that is promoting diversity is the prebiotics in our food. And prebiotics is a term that is often used, and it's a bit of an umbrella term. It actually encompasses really three, maybe more components, but polyphenols, resistant starch, and prebiotic fiber. These are all different sort of classes of prebiotics that exist in plant foods. And the reason that they're called prebiotics is that most of these escape digestion in the small intestine. So whereas your protein and your fats and your carbohydrates are being absorbed through the small intestine, and we can make use of them and into the blood in various forms, and act as fuel for energy and building blocks for protein, these prebiotic compounds pass through the small intestine, and they are instead food for those 38 trillion microbes. And I like to think about the 38 trillion microbes as kind of a little similar to different humans, in that all of us kind of have our own taste preferences. And so do these guys and gals. I'm kind of humanizing the microbes here. They also have different preferences for different types of prebiotics. And this is why diversity in our diet, eat the rainbow, is really important, because each of those different colors is representing different types of prebiotics, which are then feeding different types of these healthy microbes. And when, as we keep more of these happier, they proliferate. These are the good gut bugs. They proliferate, and we develop this more diverse microbiome. And at the same time, as we're doing that, we actually suppress the growth of more pathogenic, you know, the bad guys, the bacteria that we want to have less of. And the downstream benefit of this really kind of begins in the gut, but then it does have systemic effects throughout the body, for our heart and our brain. In the gut, what this is doing, as we're building this diversity and we're keeping all of these microbes happy, they are producing compounds. They're feeding on that prebiotic, And out the other side, they produce these metabolites or compounds like short-chain fatty acids, for example. And I'm sure you've spoken about butyrate before or acetate. These short-chain fatty acids are very good at reducing inflammation, helping keep the gut lining intact and the sort of tight junctions nice and healthy. And the net effect of this is stopping the kind of leakage of compounds that can be inflammatory, that could enter our blood system and trigger an immune response. So the take home point here, and this is only speaking to one part of fiber, because fiber has a whole another side. I'm talking just about prebiotic fiber, is that when you're consuming enough fiber and it's from a diverse range of plants, you keep this microbiome ecosystem healthy, balanced, diverse, and it's rewarding you through the production of these short chain fatty acids. They keep your gut lining intact, and they tend to also drive down inflammation throughout the body. And you mentioned earlier the Stanford study that could be, you know, that maybe you want to add something to what I just had to say, but we could also talk about the Stanford study here too.
Well, I want to go down all the pathways you just opened up there. I want to talk about the other side of fiber. I want to talk about the Stanford study, but I'm already feeling remotivated about eating the rainbow. And I have a few follow-up questions. So it's, you know, gut microbiome and stool testing has become really popular to look at the diversity in the microbiome. And it's interesting because it's like the very beginning of this type of research where people can kind of understand which bugs are the most, you know, you have the largest quantity of, and which ones you have the fewest quantity of. And some of these studies are even, or tests are even drilling down into the types of foods or fibers that feed the bugs that are maybe dying off in your gut. Without kind of going down that path and spending a bunch of money on stool testing and trying to drill down into, you know, adding more apple pectin to your diet, for example, or something like that, how do you ensure your eating the rainbow and creating diversity in your own personal, you know, eating your meal at meal times, and how do you recommend people do it at home?
So a top level is I guess understanding that these components we're talking about are found essentially only in plants, and so you're going to access them from fruits and vegetables, you know, whole grains if you eat them, legumes, nuts, and seeds. And sprouts, I should add to that, which is kind of seeds as well. I always like to add that one in there. I think sprouts are particularly healthy. And so top level is just thinking about your dietary pattern and do you have the food groups in your diet consistently, okay? And then we can take a step down from that level and think about interesting the gut microbiome project, which is led by a microbiome researcher, Rob Knight, and his team, that they looked at over 10,000 stool samples from people all around the world, lots of Americans, Australians, and they were able to identify that compared to people who consumed less than 10 unique plants a week, those who consumed 30 or more unique plants had that microbiome diversity that you and I are talking about, that we want to build and encourage. So, you know, that can seem a little daunting, and or someone might think that 30 is easy. It kind of depends on where they're coming from. It is probably a little harder than I think most people think, and it's actually quite an instructive exercise if someone just wants to get a bit of feedback about how much diversity is in their diet. Is across the course of the week, every time you eat a different plant, just write it down, and if you score low, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just something to work from. And you'll find as you get sort of across the second half of the week, it gets much harder because, you know, I can put my hand up. I do tend to fall into the habit of eating the exact same foods. And so this exercise serves as a reminder to try and mix it up more. When you walk into the grocery store, have a look around at the produce section. You know, maybe there's some stuff that's on sale that you've never tried before and you haven't been introducing, and thinking about, you know, trying that out, finding a fun recipe or way to make it taste good and introducing that. So having those food groups, thinking about diversity of plants within those food groups. And I think that's kind of my top level recommendations. Now, those kits that you mentioned, you know, this is all very emerging science. So I'm sort of watching it and I'm very open-minded about it. I tend to be very skeptical of brand new shiny objects, and sometimes they're sort of hype outpacing the science. However, in saying that, you know, back to what we were talking about earlier, I do think a level of personalization is needed. And I think that, you know, we have these characteristics, but there are going to be individual responses to certain foods. And so I'm, you know, quite open to tools like this in the future being something that people can lean on, providing they're actually accessible in terms of pricing and whatnot. I don't think that any of the feedback from these tools will say, you should do a carnivore diet. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be more about just modifying and tweaking things within what we already know is a healthy dietary pattern.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's kind of interesting just what's coming out. And I've, you know, I love to be a little bit of a lab rat, but I'm in the same boat as you, where I'm like, I don't know necessarily if this is validated in enough people for me to feel like I should change my diet based on it. But I love the accessibility of writing down all the produce that you eat in a week. One of the ways that I diversify what we eat is Sebastian, my three-year-old, when we get to the Ecology Center, which is our little farm stand, it's kind of like a farmer's market, but it's always there. And it's on the edge of a farm. We're very lucky to have that access here in Southern California, just to be in a place where produce is grown. And he can see that, but I always have him pick something that he's never picked before, you know, and it's something, sometimes it's, you know, a vegetable that I've never made before. Just based on the fact that it looks a lot of times like it's from, I don't know, like the dinosaur age, what they're willing to grow here. But I think when it comes to diversity, when I saw that study, you know, that's the kind of study that motivates me to say, I'm putting the onion and the garlic in the pan first before I saute those veggies, because I'm going from just sauteing broccoli to having broccoli and garlic and onion. And then when I'm in the, you know, produce section going, how can I add an herb to this? Because I think those are, you know, the allium family and the herbs are really an amazing way to all of a sudden
absolutely
double or triple the amount of plants on your plate without actually having to say, I just sat down to 4 cups of cruciferous vegetables and now I'm a bloated mess, going from never having veggies to having a lot of fiber. And maybe we can touch on that too, and the other side of fiber.
Yeah, I love that. I love what you said about your son. I think it's fun. Anytime you can make these things fun is great, especially with kids. And it's a really good point about herbs and spices and alliums. These count. These are a unique plant, and herbs and spices in particular are very rich in polyphenols, which I mentioned before fall under that prebiotic banner. So that's a great point. That does make it a little easier to sort of hit that 30 unique plant mark if someone's trying to get there.
Absolutely. Sorry. Let's talk about the other side of fiber.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked about how it's loaded with prebiotics, but what else does fiber do?
So usually here, I like to talk about insoluble fiber and the benefits of that side of things. And really, I believe one of the biggest benefits is the decrease in transit time. So that's the type of fiber that helps our stool move through more quickly. And there are some significant advantages, or at least thought to be some significant advantages of that. It means that there is, you know, potentially less time for what are thought to be potentially carcinogenic compounds to be in contact with the digestive system. But it also, you know, by just keeping us regular and having regular bowel movements reduces, you know, likelihood of being constipated, and that's always helpful too.
Yeah, I always think about the reabsorption of things that we're trying to get rid of, like the reabsorption of old cholesterol, the reabsorption of old sex hormones like estrogen, and seeing these imbalances on clients' blood tests. I just love, I mean, we can talk about why we love fiber all day, but I do love that when you're talking about increasing transit time, we can talk, we call it trains around here in our family. We want to keep the trains rolling and we don't want them stopping on the track. And so I love that as well. Another way to get fiber in is in fermented foods. And this awesome study just came out of Stanford and talks about the benefits of fermented foods for our immune system. So I'd love for you to share that study with our audience.
Yeah. And this study, I was really excited when I knew this was coming out, and I think it gives us a lot to think about, because some of the results kind of took me a little by surprise, and I think are very instructive for how we recommend people increase plants in their diet. And perhaps if it's not working for someone because they're, you know, not responding well to a whole lot of fiber, perhaps there's a good explanation for that. So in this study, essentially, this came out of Stanford. It was a combination collab between a very well-known nutrition scientist, Professor Dr. Christopher Gardner, and the Sonnenbergs, who are like, you know, the microbiome gurus when it comes to doing research on it.
They've been referenced a number of times in my books.
Yeah. Yeah. So if there's going to be like a team that's doing this study, these are the guys you want to be doing it. And essentially what they wanted to look at was differences between increasing fiber intake and increasing fermented foods on microbiome diversity and on biomarkers of inflammation, inflammatory biomarkers, looking at, you know, over 200 different inflammatory proteins. And the hypothesis going into this was that across the board, you would see increased diversity in the subjects that were increasing their fiber. And I should say the fiber increase was from 20 grams a day to 40. And there was a little bit of a run-in process where they gradually got that up before the start of the study. And whereas the fermented food group did not increase their fiber, but they actually added quite a lot of fermented foods. And this might shock you. They added 6 serves of fermented foods a day. And we can kind of talk about maybe why they did that at the end. But subjects consumed one of these diets for 10 weeks. And what they found was that across the board, those in the fermented food group had increased diversity. So a really, really good sign. That's what we were talking about. You want to see that. And they had a decrease in a lot of these inflammatory proteins. So the fermented foods were modulating the immune system. It was becoming more robust and there was less inflammation in the body. Now, on the flip side, on the fiber side, very interestingly, the response was very personalized. And I find this fascinating because there were certain people who increased their fiber from 20 grams to 40 grams who did see an increase in diversity and a reduction in some of the inflammatory proteins. However, quite a lot of people actually saw there was no increase in the diversity and did not have a reduction in inflammation. And in fact, some of them had an increase in inflammation, right? So the research team was very surprised by that. And they went back and thought, okay, well, why would some people respond well to fiber and others not? Maybe we should look at what their baseline microbiome diversity was. And this did explain it. So if the subject had a healthy, diverse, robust microbiome, you know, maybe someone that had years of eating a healthy diet, getting out in nature, you know, perhaps they didn't have a history of taking a lot of antibiotics, and those people increased their fiber, they did well. They did really well. Whereas someone who had very minimal diversity at baseline, so we could describe that as perhaps a sort of less robust, bit of a weaker gut, they struggled increasing their fiber from 20 to 40 grams. Mm-hmm. Now, we can do all sorts of kind of thought experiments and kind of hypothesize about what does this mean? Because, I mean, essentially, this is just one single study and that's what it shows. And I'm sure they'll tease out things in future research. But my sort of main points that I've walked away from here are that fermented foods are great. I would have liked to have seen maybe another group only doing two or three serves of fermented foods as opposed to six, because this study doesn't show us, would you still get the same benefits from less fermented foods? You know, the researchers think so, but that needs to be tested. And the reason that they did six serves is it's a bit of a trick in these, the way that you design these studies these days. It's very hard to get grant money from the NIH. Mm-hmm. And it's if they ran this study first off and did just looked at two serves of fermented foods and the results were a non-significant finding, it'd be very hard to get funding for another study. Mm-hmm. So what you do is you start with a high number of serves, find a significant finding, and then you go back and you ask for more money and
got to blow it out first and work your way back.
That's right. It's a little strategy that I know they use. So firstly, fermented foods seem to be really good for us. And I think the takeaway here is, you know, sauerkraut and kimchi, and they did use kombucha. I think if you're going to use kombucha, it's either homemade or a non-pasteurized kombucha with the live probiotics. They also had dairy, fermented sort of dairy products in here that have cultures in them, these types of food, and kefir as well. So I think introducing these into our diet is a great thing. I'm not sure whether six serves a day is achievable for most people. It's certainly, I can tell you, it's not that achievable for me. Yeah. But I am working in a few serves, at least wherever I remember. And then I think the other instructive thing from this study is that, you know, maybe not everyone does respond the same way to increasing their fiber. And maybe this personalized response is really interesting to explore, because then we can actually help people better. And, you know, they are going and running another study. And what they're going to do is look at people that have low baseline diversity and see maybe if you add fermented foods in or a probiotic before increasing fiber for a period, does that help that person increase their diversity a little bit? And then you increase fiber and they tolerate it better. So there's a little bit more for us to kind of understand here. But, you know, fermented foods are good. If you're adding a lot of plants and fiber and you're not feeling great, I would say back it off and go low and slow.
We have this knee-jerk reaction to go very quickly and try to change our diet overnight. And I'm sure some people listening are like, I can do six servings of fermented veggies a day. I'm just going to go for that, you know,
yeah.
Especially if they love it. But I always, and you're Australian, so this makes sense. I always talk about the Great Barrier Reef. I'm like, our microbiomes are the Great Barrier Reef. And like, if we went out there and just put a bunch of Miracle-Gro everywhere, only certain parts of the reef would grow and everything else mm-hmm. would die off. And it's kind of looking at like the old way that we used to treat the microbiome too, with like the overgrowth of yeast and fungus and candida mm-hmm. and people would just go at it with antibacterials and antifungals instead of saying like, well, what if we just like fed the good guys nice and slow and saw what happened there and allowed for it to like rebuild itself naturally over time. And I mean, it's hard to look back and think about what we've learned, because you mentioned like, there are a bunch of people who have low diversity because they had a bunch of antibiotics growing up. That was me, you know, and that's
heartbreaking. Me as well.
That's heartbreaking to look back and be like, anytime I had mm-hmm. the sniffles, I was given a Z-Pack or mm-hmm. something stronger, like a Levaquin or Cipro. Like, oh, it like breaks my heart mm-hmm. to think about it now. But mm-hmm. But low and slow. It's like anything. We have to get consistent, be relentlessly consistent, and work on it. And that's when we see the benefit mm. at low and slow.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm with you on the antibiotic thing. I think they're prescribed too regularly, are of course very important and can be very life-saving as well. But I think one of the cool things with anyone who's listening who perhaps has had a lot of antibiotics is to remember that after our sort of 2 or 3 years of life, the number of species we have is kind of set. And even if you have antibiotics, you rarely would you actually lose a species completely. You're just losing the numbers of those. And so, you know, through healthy lifestyle habits, you can build that back up and you can achieve a very healthy microbiome. So, you know, it's not all doom and gloom. You can get there.
There you are being positive again. I love it. I love it with action steps. Let's talk a little bit more about the diversity of color and polyphenol specifically. I know that polyphenol research is really robust and exciting around cognition and understanding how it can promote health. Can you share the research on that?
Yeah, this is really interesting. And, you know, I think you made a really good point then. You were talking about some of the history of things that people were doing and how knowledge has expanded. And, you know, I think it's really important just to stay open-minded. And a lot of this science is developing, emerging, and you do the best with the information you have at the time. So, and that's what makes this really exciting to talk about for me in particular. Now, this area of polyphenols is like very, very new. It is emerging science. You know, it wasn't too long ago, you know, that essentially we thought the polyphenols were absorbed in the small intestine. And that's true about 5%. I sort of skipped over that before. I shouldn't forget, about 5% of polyphenols are absorbed in the small intestine. 95% pass through to the microbiome and are metabolized by the bacteria. But the last few years of science has actually allowed us to look at when polyphenols are metabolized by bacteria, there are 500, 1,000, probably more metabolites produced that then go into the bloodstream. So for a long time, we actually didn't have the technology to even identify those and know that they were there. So we presumed that what was happening to polyphenols is that you consume them, you get a small amount through your small intestine, and we could see that they're in the bloodstream for a couple of hours. Now, here's the crazy thing. The 500 to 1,000 metabolites that are produced are actually in the bloodstream for about 2 days. So when you have a handful or a cup of blueberries, for example, that are very rich in a class of polyphenols called anthocyanins, those anthocyanins are consumed, metabolized by your bacteria in your large intestine, and well, most of them anyway, and they produce these metabolites that are then in your blood for a couple of days, up to a couple of days, which is, you know, fascinating. And it's believed that these metabolites are responsible for a lot of the kind of downstream effects that other science has been able to tease out following the consumption of certain polyphenol-rich foods like blueberries, for example. And you mentioned cognition. So berries in particular, these are an interesting sort of food group because of all the different sort of fruits that are rich in polyphenols, it's probably the one type of fruit that's had the most research on it. So part of me thinks that berries are amazing, but on the other hand, I think perhaps they've just more researchers looking at them and you'd also see all these benefits from these other fruits. But from a cognition point of view, large sort of observational studies which show associations show people that are regularly consuming berries tend to have lower risk of neurodegenerative diseases. And their brains actually perform as if they're younger. And this is when they're looking at elderly populations. And that's really interesting because that sort of speaks to the fact that perhaps, again, this is from observational research, so it's not sort of cause and effect, but perhaps these berries are having some sort of protective effect long-term on our nervous system. And then we have randomized controlled trials. And these are tend to look, you know, much more shorter-term studies looking at cognition in kind of our day-to-day. How do our brains perform following exposure to blueberries, these anthocyanin rich foods? And there's been a whole heap of studies now in children, in healthy adults, in elderly populations with sort of mild cognitive impairment. And, you know, I don't want to make this out like this is a silver bullet, but the results are very, very promising. We do see enhanced cognition for a number of different domains of cognitive function, not all of them, but certainly, you know, things like recall and accuracy and speed, depending on the study, they do tend to be improved when someone is consuming blueberries or blueberry powder compared to a placebo. And what's interesting is it seems that there's only a difference between the blueberry smoothie or powder and the placebo when the task is quite challenging. So if it's a very basic task, then the addition of those blueberries doesn't really do too much. But if you're putting your brain under a sort of more significant demand, that's where there does seem to be a benefit to having these polyphenols in your circulation. Now, what's kind of at play here? There's probably a lot of mechanisms, and really, I don't think we understand them. And most of the researchers writing about this do say that, although they do put forward a few different ideas. And there's a combination of animal and human studies that have been able to show, for example, following the consumption of anthocyanins, you actually get increased cerebral blood perfusion. So blood flow to the brain increases, and that increases at about the 1 to 3 hour mark, depending on the person, which lines up with these randomized controlled trials showing that people do perform better cognitively. So if you have an exam or an important business meeting that you think is going to be quite strenuous, have some blueberries in the morning or a blueberry smoothie. And, you know, based on that science, it will likely help. Now, in terms of, I mentioned before that some of those observational studies are looking more at sort of chronic benefits. There's a few different explanations for this. These polyphenols also increase brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which is, I guess, in simple forms, it's a protein, but it is kind of like fertilizer for the brain. So it can help your neurons grow. It can help you develop more connections between neurons, sort of remodeling of the brain, which is, or neuroplasticity, it's often called, which is very important for memory, and it protect against decline in cognition as we age. But also these molecules seem to reduce inflammation. And we know that inflammation is a sort of hallmark feature of a number of these chronic conditions. So there's a lot of different mechanisms at play there. I think bottom line, and an interesting question I quite often get is like, how much? And you know, most of the studies that are looking at these benefits are sort of looking at about that one cup mark. So that's probably two serves of berries. I think if you can add those to your diet, and remembering this is not about one particular day, it's consistency over time. But I think it's certainly worthwhile.
Absolutely, you're giving us all the motivation and like the excitement around getting out there and getting these plant foods, especially polyphenols, in our diet. I mean, I could talk to you all day. I'm going to be honest. I wish we could, but I'd love to end today's podcast talking about one tip that you tell everyone to do around a mealtime and what you eat.
Okay. So this is hard, one tip, because I can talk. Brevity is not my strong suit. One meal that I would try and I would recommend people try to have is a daily salad. And we've kind of spoken a bit about brain health here, but there's a whole lot of research showing the benefits of dark leafy greens, you know, nuts and seeds that provide lots of unsaturated fats. And so I love to try and remember to have a daily salad where you have some mixed dark leafy greens. That could be spinach or arugula or kale, even throw some lettuce in there. Lettuce is good too. And you can put some berries into this. This is a bit of a an extra boost. Put some strawberries, work well in this, I find. Some avocado, some walnuts. Put some olive oil over the top of that if you use oils. And, you know, sometimes I'll mix olive oil with a sort of mustard and some lemon, and that makes a very quick, very nice dressing that you can just run over those dark leafy greens, and it makes them more enjoyable. And I'm all for more enjoyable, because that means you're going to eat them more often. And also the fats in that oil are actually going to help you absorb a lot of the vitamins that are in those dark leafy greens. So that's important too. And then on this salad, which is a bit of a brain boosting salad, and something that I think if you try and have on the daily is just a great way to really improve your overall dietary pattern. You could add some form of protein. So I like to throw in chickpeas. If someone eats seafood, I think a sort of source of fatty fish would be good in here, like salmon, for example. Mix it all through together. Quite easy to make and very delicious to enjoy. So that would be my tip on that. And then if I was to throw in one other tip, I think eating mindfully. And this is a big discussion in itself, but we've been talking a lot about microbiome and digestion. And I think a lot of our problems are not necessarily just the food that we're eating, but how we're eating and who we're eating with. And are we distracted by the TV and eating sort of mindlessly and scoffing it down? And we do know that that does directly affect our digestion. And I think everyone listening will have experienced that. If you are just shoveling the food in and you're scrolling on the Instagram, and look, I put my hand up, I'm guilty of this. And every time I do it, I'm like, I really need to take my own advice. But, you know, it's very important to get into that more relaxed state for your digestion to really kick into gear. And so that would be, you know, two of many of my tips.
Well, I know what I'm doing. It's only 10 a.m. here, but I know what I'm doing for lunch today. Bone away, beautiful green leafy salad, sprouts and walnuts and strawberries. I'm going to make that olive oil mustard dressing, and I'm going to load it with some healthy fiber-rich protein.
Yep. And fermented foods. Maybe get some kraut on there.
Yeah, let's do it. I love it. Simon, this has been such a pleasure. You're a joy. You're putting out some really awesome, easy tips. You have an amazing platform. Where can people follow along and learn more?
Yeah. So if you want to listen more, you can tune into the Plant Proof podcast. And then on the socials at plant_proof. And I recently wrote a book called The Proof is in the Plants.
I love it. We're going to put links to everything, including your brand new book, in the show notes. And I will make sure to be sharing all of this on IG so that people can find you and listen.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And I appreciate everyone for taking the time. And it was a joy. Thanks, Kelly.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Be Well by Kelly. Please subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Learn more at bewellbykelly.com and follow me on Instagram at bewellbykelly. I would love if you picked up my books, Body Love and Body Love Every Day. They're sold on Amazon and at all major booksellers.